Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Kilowatt, a podcast about electric vehicles, renewable energy, autonomous driving, and much, much more. My name is Bodie, and I am your host, and I'm really excited to get to today's episode, folks. I sat down with Ed Bernardin, who is the Vice President of Motorsports and Racing Strategy for Siemens Digital Industries Software, and he's also the host of the Future Car Podcast. And you can tell Ed is a pro because this started off as an interview where I was interviewing Ed and it quickly developed into a conversation. Like I had my list of questions and they were in different categories depending on what Ed brought up, because honestly, I don't know much about motorsports, whether it's e-motorsports or just motorsports in general. So I was very organized and I had all my stuff set up. And talking to Ed is like talking to somebody that I've known honestly for years, and we just threw out the script and just had a conversation, which is my favorite way to do things, to be honest with you. Ed's a heck of a nice guy. We started the podcast off right. I had a liquid death Arnold Palmer or Dead Billionaire, which is basically iced tea and lemonade, and he started off with a, hey, are you drinking a beer right now? And so that was just, we just started off on a good foot. Yeah, but I just really enjoyed this conversation. I hope you enjoy this conversation. I did try to squeeze in some questions here and there, but honestly, this is a conversation and I loved it. So let's go ahead and welcome Ed to the show.
Bodie, thanks for having me on. Great to be here.
So you are the VP of Motorsports Racing Strategy at Siemens Digital. Was this your goal when you were a little boy? Did you want to be in racing?
Well, I grew up in Indianapolis, and that's the racing capital of the world, so the Indianapolis 500. And my parents were actually immigrants from Italy, and that was the time when Mario Andretti was like a big star there. He came from the same part of Italy as my parents. So in our family, it wasn't about basketball and baseball and football. It was about racing. And so, yes, I was. I think I've been to every Indianapolis 500, almost every single one, since I've been in high school. So, it really all started there.
How do you go from being an engineer to being the VP or a VP at Siemens Digital?
Well, it's actually a little bit of a twisted kind of path, but straight out of grad school, I studied controls and robotics and that type of thing. And my first job was at the Draper Labs, which is in Cambridge, Mass. And they're known for guidance systems and things like that, but they started a commercial business and our group was developing robots to make clothes and blue jeans, t-shirts, parts for men's suits, all sorts of stuff. Anyways, we developed all this expertise in handling flexible fabrics with robots. And then we sort of did a shift. We said, hey, carbon fiber is a fabric. And aerospace industry and the automotive industry would probably pay a lot more for robots than they would in the apparel industry. So that's when we actually shifted over to that. And we started building machines, companies like Sikorsky, United Technologies, Ford. A lot of these companies would buy our machines and utilize them. And we also figured out that, so carbon fiber being a fabric, you have to distort it from a flat sheet into three dimensions. And in order to make that happen without wrinkling, because if you start to wrinkle carbon fiber, it doesn't have the strength and stiffness you want. We thought there might be software that could do that, but it didn't exist. And so we created it and we said, wow, we could actually make a company doing this. And four of us started a company called Composite Design Technologies, later changed to Vistagy. And I was in charge of the, I was actually, although I have an engineering background, I was actually in charge of sales for that company. We grew it to from four people to about 80 and about 15 million in sales. And most of our sales were to aerospace companies, like the defense giants and things like that, Boeing. But our test ground was Formula One. And that's where I developed. It was a great opportunity, right? Here's my chance to get back into motorsports. And so when we had our international strategy, it sort of went like this. It was only like four or five of us at the time. Well, let's go to the UK first. They speak English there. There's a lot of racing teams. I bet they would love that because that's the hotbed of Formula One. And over the 15, 20 years or so that we grew the company before we were acquired by Siemens, we developed a lot of relationships to this day that we still have in the Formula One business and really got to understand, in Formula One, especially when it comes to carbon fiber and advanced materials and that type of thing, you would learn from them in a month or in a couple of months, what it would take years to learn from an aerospace company where the speed of development was much slower. But anyways, we were acquired eventually and we continued that work in carbon fiber and software for designing with it. But I took on a role, I guess you'd call it special projects. And since I had this love for racing, I was able to get funding from actually the corporate headquarters in Germany to do a project for the FIA. The FIA is the sanctioning body for Formula One and other race series too. In this particular case, we were working with the World Rally Championship. So these are off-road rally cars. And the fans for rally are really crazy. They'll like go right up to the edge of the road and stick their arms out. Sometimes their entire bodies out in front of the cars. So what we did was, the goal of the project was to put autonomous car sensors into these rally cars to detect spectators are getting like overly anxious, shall we say. And so they could warn the authorities to come and get them out of the way. So that was really the first project. That led to several more projects, some with hydrogen drive in vehicles, others like carbon fiber based vehicles that had embedded sensors that were autonomous. But in any case, became sort of a center for people that were interested in racing. I was starting to get a lot of people coming to me. And so then they created this new position called VP of Motorsports and Racing Strategy to really not to take our approach to racing less casually and really look at it like, why are we doing this? And let's do it in a way that gives us the most benefits, because it's the three things that we looked at in racing and we're still doing it now is, one, it has to prove that the products that we have, which are products for engineering cars, planes, really any challenging engineering problem, Siemens, our division of Siemens Digital Industry Software provides solutions for that. But it has to demonstrate that these solutions work well in challenging environments. Certainly motorsports does that. It has to be sustainable, because over the past years, motorsport had gotten a bit of a bad name because they didn't seem sustainable, but they certainly have changed that in recent times. And finally, at motorsports, if you look at the audience, for instance, that Formula One has for on a racing weekend, they'll get like 70 million viewers, which is not that far away from what a Super Bowl is in that 100 to 120. So what we're trying to do is take those three things and pull them together and leverage them as best we can, in addition to showcasing what Siemens can do, not only in our division, but across all the other divisions, because it's a pretty big company. And that's, so I guess to answer your question, I didn't plan it out, but there was always that magnet, it was drawing me back to racing. So if that's what you really want to do, I think when you're going through your career, you got to always look for opportunities to go back to what you really like to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Is there, you mentioned the rally sports. Everybody who listens to this show is probably familiar with Formula E. Are there other motorsports out there that are moving electric or even hydrogen powered? And we'll talk about that here in a moment.
Oh, absolutely. So there certainly is Formula E. Like you said, people are very familiar with that. There's another series that was also started by the same person. So Alejandro Agag is he's the founder of Formula E, and he started another series 3-4 years ago called Extreme E. Extreme E races electric SUVs in areas, it's off-road series. So it's sort of like rally, but instead of one car on the track at a time, you have like, I think it's like 5 or 6 cars race together. But they go to locations that are challenged by climate change. Greenland, the glaciers in Greenland, rainforests, the deserts, whatever it might be. And there's no live audience. So the whole goal behind this series is to draw attention to areas that are challenged by climate change, to promote sustainability, and also develop technology that's relevant to that. So they are electric drive. They have hydrogen-powered charging for these vehicles on their side. So everything is focused around that. And when you go to, you can attend these events. There's a limited number of people that can, and they'll have talks on, they might have talks with the driver, like a typical motorsport event, but they'll also do things like have someone come in. And for instance, they have a program called the Legacy Program. And I attended one of those. And one of the things we did was we planted seagrass. It was in Sardinia, or one of the races was it. And he said, well, why plant seagrass? And it turns out that seagrass is one of the few plants that actually takes carbon and puts it back into the ground, unlike a tree that takes it in. But when the tree decays, it all goes back. And anchors of ships, rip all the seagrass up. But there's all sorts of things they do like that. And so there's that whole focus on sustainability. And the focus on the technology that's like electric drive as you have in Formula E. However, they are now looking at hydrogen drive, and Siemens actually has a project with them to help them in the development of that hydrogen drive. So it's a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle that they're looking at. They'll probably be testing it towards the end of this season and actually racing it next year side by side with the battery electric version of it. And I think this is a great example of some of the innovation that racing does, because the first thing you think is, okay, it's a hydrogen fuel cell. There's the balance of how much does the fuel cell do, how much does the battery do, and sort of maximizing that. But then there's never been a racing event before where you have to refuel, dozens of race cars with hydrogen. It's the infrastructure of that is safety is number one. So what we learn on that, I think, will in making sure that you can deliver hydrogen safely to these vehicles, it will certainly apply to the infrastructure that you're going to need when hydrogen, makes its way on the commercial side. But they're a great example. Alejandro Agag has also done an electric boat series called E1. I think they had their first race earlier this year. They're very futuristic mm-hmm. looking. It looks like it's something from Star Wars, these boats, hydrofoil. Tom Brady, the quarterback, Super Bowl quarterback, of course, he actually owns one of the teams.
Oh, wow.
And he, his team won the very first E1 race. And I remember Alejandro, I was with him at one of the events, and this was before the series started. And I said, oh, tell me about Tom Brady. I've never met Tom Brady. And he goes, I've never met anyone so competitive. He really wants to win this boat race. And sure enough, he did. But so those are a couple of, I think, good examples of, where how Formula E under the helm of Alejandro Agag and his team has, starting to evolve here to even other series.
Excellent. Can you talk about some of the EV technologies or autonomous driving technologies that you've seen that have kind of worked their way down in, your career in this space?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that's surprising, maybe even to take a little bit of a step back from that, is there's so many things that we take for granted now that actually came from racing. Probably the most famous one is in the first Indianapolis 500 in 1911, the winner of that race, Ray Haroon, was the winner, and he had a rear view mirror. It was the first time a rear view mirror was ever used in a race, and he won. And the reason was back then the cars couldn't make it all the way around the track because it's like 2.5 miles, so they carried a mechanic with them. And he figured, and the mechanic was also the rear view mirror. You know, it's like a rear view camera that talks to you. And so he figured out, oh, if I don't have a mechanic in my car, the car is going to go faster. But anyways, rear view mirror, seat belts, disc brakes, radial tires. These are all, you know, great examples of things that were invented in racing. Materials like aluminum, magnesium, carbon fiber, all those kinds of things. And I think more recently, as you're saying, with respect to electric vehicle technology, the Formula E series has done a lot as well. 800 volt charging was first used there, or the 800 volt battery system, excuse me, was first used there. Silicon carbide power inverters. But most importantly, there's a lot of rules they have on the ability to change batteries during a season, the ability to use energy very, very efficiently. So the amount of research and work that's put into those cars in terms of power and energy management has really helped the automotive teams and to take what they've learned there and apply it in the commercial sector. And I mean, Mercedes, BMW, Audi, Jaguar, NIO, Nissan are all examples of teams that have at least at one point, you know, worked with Formula E.
That kind of brings up, and maybe I'm going off topic here just a little bit, but that brings up something that I was thinking about is what is the strategy? How does that differ for racers who are using an electric powertrain versus the traditional gas powered or not gas, I guess, fuel powered cars? Like there's got to be changes that the driver and the team have to make so that they can be successful. It can't be a one-to-one.
You know, it's a great point because and an excellent question, because ultimately it all comes down to the rules, regardless if it's an internal combustion engine or an electric car. So, I mean, like if you look over the years, first with even with Formula One, like they'll say, okay, this year we're going to have a new tire specification. Oh, okay. So that's going to impact the ability to go through the turns more quickly. Or in 22, they changed the rules there. And one of the problems they had prior to 22 was that the wings and the rules they had on aerodynamics created turbulence behind the car. So they couldn't follow very, very closely. If you can't follow very, very closely, it's hard to overtake when you go into a turn, for instance. Well, now you can. So it sort of changed that. So there's all the conventional things like the tires, what you allowed to do for aerodynamics and all that. In Formula One, all the cars are different. There's 10 teams and 10 teams of each with two drivers, and they all design their own cars from the ground up completely. There's four or five engine manufacturers that provide the engines. In Formula E, it's a little bit different. It's what they call a spec series. So a majority of the components or a significant amount of the components are exactly the same. So the car body, the tires, suspension, all those kinds of things are the same. They can certainly adjust those things on their own. However, they do give some freedom in Formula E to do things like certain powertrain components you're allowed to work with. The battery packs are all the same, but all the software for power management and all that is left up to the team. So if you're a driver, right, there's also rules for the drivers. Like there's the ability in a Formula E race to collect extra power. For a while, they had a thing where a certain driver that got the most likes during the race, right, would get an extra power boost. They actually got rid of that, but that was something they had. There are opportunities now to depending on where you are on the track and how far into the race you are, that you can get additional power that you can use in different sections of the track. So you have to be smart about how you use those. It's hard. I mean, there's a lot going on. If you ever look at like a steering wheel, I mean, even for a Formula One car, it's very, very complex. A lot of buttons on there that do different things. it's impossible sometimes for the driver to do it all on his own. So the simulation is really, really key. And depending on the conditions, the temperature of the track, the wind, the tires that you're going to use, how often you have to come in for a pit stop, all those things have to be taken into account as they develop their race strategy. So, and in fact, AI is even starting to be used a little bit to help develop some of those race strategies. At least there's talk that is being done. When it comes to how strategies are created, there's people don't really like to talk about that too much. But it is a complicated puzzle that can change, you know, as soon as it goes from sunny to being cloudy.
I understand when nobody wants to talk about strategy, but it would be foolish not to take all of that data that you get from the car and all that feedback and throw that into the AI just to see if something comes out of it. You might learn something. You might not. It might just come back with gibberish.
But I think what you just said, though, is interesting. I mean, it's no different than using ChatGPT, right? You see, you know, in fact, if you're when I prepare for my podcast and I have a guest, I'll throw it at ChatGPT and say, hey, give me 10 great questions. You look at the 10 and maybe you'll get, oh, wow, look at this one question here. It's really good. Then you ask questions about the question. Next thing you know, it might guide you in certain directions. That's probably true of any type of data, I would think. It's a tool that you should try and utilize as best you can.
Yeah, I personally use ChatGPT to and Anthropic's Claude. I use that to bounce things off of, but I don't use. I find that it talks in a way that I don't talk, and there's not anybody who's been listening to me for the last 8 years who's going to believe that I would ask a question that way or that I would talk in that way. So. I use it to bounce things off of, but then I kind of rewrite everything in my voice to make sure that it's me.
Well, you know, sometimes I almost do this almost every single time. I'll say, generate me a question or something, or tell me a little something. I said, and then the next one is pretty much something like, could you do that again with less hyperbole?
Yes.
It's like that. Like, there's no way. I'm with you. I would never say it like that, but you know, it generally is, it's helpful sometimes. If not most of the time.
No, I don't want to make it sound like I'm poo-pooing the technology. I love it. If there's an article that I'm like, man, I just cannot find the thread in this, I'll throw it into Anthropic and I'll say, give me the high points and make them bulleted. And then it will do that. And then I'll go back and I'll reread the article. And I'm like, okay, I now I'm getting this. Because you get into habits. Like we all have pattern recognition. If the data is showing us a new pattern, we may not recognize that right away. Whereas AI is going to be like, oh yeah, this is the pattern that you should be looking at.
I think you sort of hit it, right? I mean, and this is definitely true in racing because there's so many variables that you can change. I mean, you'd like to think that, oh, maybe I'll change the battery management software, or maybe I'll change the camber on the tire, or maybe I'll tell the driver to change his driving technique. I mean, there's so many variables, and maybe you're used to, like, I still race go-karts and even on a go-kart, as simple as it is, it's very, very coupled in how all the amount of air that's in the tires or the width of the tires or the weight balance or whatever it might be. And you sometimes fall into a rut of only changing the one or two things that you're familiar with. But if you did have something on something complex like a Formula One or a Formula E car that said, hey, you might want to think about this or changing these two things at the same time, as a suggestion tool is probably really, really valuable. Of course, you know, how do you get it to analyze these reams and reams of data? It has to somehow learn.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I don't know how you teach it. You'd have to figure. I mean, if you've seen on a Formula One race, there'll be four or five engineers that sit on the not on the track itself, but right on that pit wall. Then there'll be a group inside the garage. Well, first of all, there's the crew that does all the tire changes and all that. That's quite a big crew. But then there's also another set of maybe, I don't know, half a dozen or so that are analyzing data. And then back home, at headquarters, there's a room full of 20 or 30 people that are each with their own screen analyzing more data. So it's almost like, I don't know if you what the total of that is, but overall, you know, you probably have got several dozen, you know, 3-4 dozen people that are on in real time taking all this information and saying, oh, you better bring them in 2 laps sooner. I think you'll end up finishing the race 5 seconds faster, which could make the difference between, you know, second and fifth place or something, right? So,
yeah, that's really interesting. And there is, you know, obviously there are people out there who are data scientists and who do all this AI stuff. My oldest daughter, she owns her own social media agency. So they do clients, mostly museums. And she'll take I'm giving away the family secret here, but she'll take audience sentiment from social media and she'll run that through her ChatGPT program that she built. And then she has the sentiment for the audience based on this post or over a certain period of time. It's really powerful. So you take that and times it by 1,000,000. I guess that's what you would get for F1 racing or any major motorsport.
Well, you know, it's interesting, right? Because there's one body of data, which is, you know, I don't know how many sensors there's on a Formula One car, but there's many, many, I would imagine dozens of sensors doing all sorts of things. And then there's the telemetry that's measuring accelerations and you're certainly monitoring the motor for its power output and whatever it might be. So there's that body data, which is numbers that are being collected. But then the driver comes in. And one of the things about driving racing and driving a race car is that it's certainly it's visual, but there's a lot of tactical feeling because they've done experiments where they would put Novocaine or they would numb the backside of the driver, the part that's in contact with the seat. And they found that when they do that, the driver can't feel if the car's on the edge of adhesion. Hmm. In other words, if you throw yourself into a turn too fast, you'll spin out. If you throw yourself into the turn too slowly or not fast enough, you don't win. So you're always on the edge of spinning out. You're always on the edge of spinning out. And how you feel that is you're starting to spin out and the car's starting to slip. Maybe it can slip just a little bit more. But then other times, you're used to how well this car could take a turn, but now when you start to turn, it doesn't want to turn, or the back end is slipping out too much, and the driver will come back and they'll say to the crew, this is additional information, they'll say, it's a little loose, which means the tail is slipping out, or it's understeering. I want it to turn and it doesn't want to turn, but it only does this on turn 3, doesn't do it on turn 4, on and on and on, and I guess you got to record that and give that to the AI system as well, right?
For sure.
Or have it do some voice recognition. There's that human element, I guess, right? That you got to incorporate there somehow. Like I said, it's not a big stream of data that's coming in. It's another source that has to be incorporated. But over time, there's no reason that system couldn't analyze that as well and look for correlations between the different pieces.
Absolutely. I'm sure they could get, this is getting really nerdy, but I'm sure they can get down with like an Apple Watch or some other type of measurement, like how well the driver slept versus how well they slept on this race. And they could put all of that information in there. I'm sure what they had for breakfast, whether or not, you know, they went to the bathroom in the morning. I'm sure all of this stuff, how much water intake could be put in, and they could spit out how the car should be set up to maximize performance for that driver.
It's endless, right? Oh, I'm in a bad mood today because...
Oh, good one. You know,
yeah.
That's a good one.
There's the emotional. I suppose that could... maybe somebody's listening. They're gonna take all this and try and figure out how to pull it out. Or maybe it's already been done. Who knows? But simulation does play a really big part. I think in Formula One, it's... I know over the years... I've spent a lot of time in different engineering organizations and seen the cars being assembled and all that. But one of the things I've never seen, and few employees actually get to see it, is the simulator that the drivers use. And because when they show up at the track, because there's, again, this Formula One with limited track time, and this applies to all the different race series, they've spent so much time in the simulator because they have to do that to take advantage of the limited testing time that they have, that real physical in-a-vehicle testing time. And most of the time when they show up, that car is really, really close. That car and driver close to to the maximum performance you're going to get, which is way unlike, if you want to call it the old days, when they didn't have those simulations and that type of thing. So, yeah. And I suppose AI could probably even help with trying to improve those simulations and knowing what stimulus that you might want to put in there to help improve a driver more quickly and get to the optimum performance with less time on the simulator.
For sure. Yeah, that's really interesting. I did not have any of that in my questions, so it's good. Let's move a little bit to autonomous driving. So you talked about, what'd you say, it was 1911, the first F1 race?
Oh, yeah, 1911 was actually the first Indianapolis 500. I think the first F1 race was probably in the 50s, late 40s, early 50s, but around in there sometime. But 1911 was when the rearview mirror at the Indianapolis 500, yes.
Got it. Okay, so if we're taking that as our time frame, like our start point, at that point in time, everything was pretty much on the driver, whether, or you know, shifting gears, the power to the tires is exactly what it was going to be. There was nothing internally in the car that was going to change power to the tires. But over time, we've built in things to help the driver eliminate fatigue, but also have better control of the car at higher speeds and all that stuff. And that's I consider that a form of autonomous driving. But as it is commercially, how do you think autonomous driving is going to be folded into motorsports? In this, it doesn't really matter if it's electric vehicles or not, because part of the appeal is the talent that these people have that are driving these vehicles.
Yeah. Well, there's, I think you've raised two interesting points. I'll take the first one is this whole idea of certainly there's fully autonomous and there, it's gotten to that point now where there are some racing series that are starting to do that. But over time, right, there's things like traction control and ABS and a lot of these things that we take for granted now came into racing and sometimes were taken out because it started to level the playing field a little bit too much, right? And in some ways, you could say ABS or anti-lock braking is a form of it's certainly a technology assist. And sure. I mean, and you can even take autonomous car technology and say, hey, I'm going to put it in the car, but it's not going to do anything unless you get in trouble. Right. The technology is the same, but it's not fully autonomous driving where say, hey, take me from A to B or whatever it might be. How does this fit in full autonomy? How does that fit into racing? And we've talked a lot about technology in racing, but I think we have to remember racing is a form of entertainment. It's a marketing business. And, there's hundreds of millions of dollars that are spent on race series like, Formula One and many, many tens of millions in Formula E and IndyCar and all that. And probably overall, even getting into the hundreds of millions in sponsorship costs in the areas. If you want to get your name on the side of the car, even in IndyCar or NASCAR, any of those, you're into the tens of millions of dollars. But it is a marketing business and it has to be entertaining. So whatever it is they're going to do, they're going to do it to draw in those 70 million viewers every weekend that want to watch Formula One. And Formula One has gone in the past, I think it's 2 or 3 years, maybe closer to 4, is they created a series called Drive to Survive. I don't know if you ever watched Drive to Survive. It's a Netflix series.
I have not, but just a really quick side note. I took my father-in-law to lunch and he was telling me about it. And the moment I got back, I got the email for you about coming on the show. So...
Have you taken a look at all?
I have not yet. I don't watch a lot of TV, not because I don't want to, it's just time-wise. But yeah, it is something that is on my list of things to look at.
Well, so you could think of it as a reality series about what goes on in the behind the scenes in Formula One. And they have the rights to pretty much film wherever they want. And it's very, there's 10 teams. It's very competitive. There's a lot of crazy personalities and all sorts of things that go on. And it's propelled it's one of the top series on Netflix, and it's propelled Formula One way beyond they've ever been. And they finally got to the point where they're starting to sell out races. They never used to do that. And now they sell out, you know, if not the whole, every single race, but many, many in a year. It's really helped them a lot in growing the series in the United States. So now there's a race in Austin, has been there for a while, Miami. They had one in Las Vegas last year. So it's going. So if you look at an episode, and I've done this a couple of times, I said, well, what percent of the time in 45 minutes are they actually showing a race car on the track? I think, and you can't quote me on this 100%, but it's usually a third or less, I would think. Because most of it is the drivers walking around in the paddock, as they call it, or the team principals talking about other team principals or problems they're having with the FIA or whatever it might be. And that kind of drama is what draws people in. So now you're going to have an autonomous race car, and the risk of the human, you know, that's in there, or the drama of the human driver is gone. Will people really want to watch a bunch of computers driving around a racetrack, right? I think there's a place for this, but it's a little bit different. It's not going to ever compete with Formula One or IndyCar or NASCAR or anything like that. But from a technology development standpoint, it's the same thing, right? Of a very challenging environment, high speed, unpredictable road or track conditions, the ability to, you know, have the bandwidth of being able to react to, you know, and have the level of it's the level of strategy that you need to actually race, which is probably a level above even what an autonomous car has to do when it's driving around. So for instance, an autonomous car, it has to be careful of, you know, Is a child going to run out in front of it? Or, you know, this car, how am I going to pass this car? I got to get around it. What are the rules of the street, the speed limits? It has to be very, very complex. So you have all that in racing as well. But when you're racing, you're following someone and your goal is to pass them, but they're really, really good. And it's really hard to pass them, but you watch them through the 9 turns and you say, on turn 8, they're going a little bit wide. I'm going to take them on the inside. And then you get ready to pass them. And as you're starting to pass, you're watching, can I wait a little bit longer to put my brakes on so I can get by? So there's a strategy that is more than just the moment, shall we say, that you have to add to the capability of whatever the system, the planning system that's driving it. But again, it's this really goes back to why we work with the Formula One teams when we were developing our composite software. One of the things in racing is, hey, there's a race in 6 months or 2 weeks or whatever it is. What's the best we can do with what we got between now and then? And so you're forced to work. I mean, you might work around the clock and all that, but your development rate is really, really fast. And you know what's important to consider and not consider. And since you have to do it at such a rapid development rate, having a series that's autonomous, and there's a couple. There's the Indy Autonomous Challenge that's been around here for a couple of years. They've been at CES. And there's a new racing league called A2RL that's in Abu Dhabi. It's funded by the Emirates. And I think they've got like 7-8 teams that are going to be competing, and they've made a commitment to these teams, I think for several years now, with the end goal being not to compete against Formula One, but to get some of the brightest minds, you know, working on the challenges of driving very, very quickly with, you know, an autonomous driver. And the end goal for them is to develop technology that they can utilize in the commercial sector. So, I think it's the traditional role that racing's always had, except that I don't think you're going to have 350,000 screaming fans watching them like you do at the Indianapolis 500. I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah. So, So when I was at CES, I saw the cars laid out on the show floor for the autonomous driving series. And when I saw this, I was like, oh, this is like that. Remember the BattleBots TV show?
Yes.
I was like, yes. this is that without the carnage, right? But this is to allow young engineers who, whether they're software or hardware, develop something that could be used somewhere else in racing. But I also had another thought when I was researching this is when you have young drivers coming up, this might be a good opportunity for them to race with other cars on the track without the risk. I mean, you always have the driver's life at risk, but without really risking a whole lot of other people. Cause you know, they're not going slow. They're going pretty darn fast. And so having something that would actually give them a challenge as they're coming up through the ranks to learn how to do this. And I know you could do some of this in a simulation, but other things, you know, sometimes you just got to get out there and actually do the work. When I was a kid, we used to go to stock car races in the community I grew up in, and they all like lined up to race to their cars to start to actually start.
Oh, you get all pumped up, right?
Yeah, there's
the adrenaline is flowing.
Yeah, there's so many cool things, and autonomous driving kind of takes a little bit of that out of that that element out. And maybe it could still be interesting. It could still be a Netflix series on how people are developing all this, but I don't think it can take the place of an actual driver.
Well, you know, you got to have the Netflix series. Everyone, I mean, in fact, NASCAR has one now, golf has one, tennis, they all picked up on the Drive to Survive. But one of the things you mentioned, I think is really, really interesting is this whole, is the use of this in training. So one thing you could do is you could have an autonomous car out there and you could tell a new driver, follow it, and it'll teach you the proper line around the track.
That's good.
But another way would be to have a fully autonomous race car, but that a human could actually sit in, and you could dial it in to full autonomy. Hey, take me for a ride. And then you'd say, okay, I think I'm ready. And maybe you put it on 8 or 6, or eventually put it on 0. But, and it would tell you, hey, you're not ready for level 5 yet. You better put it back on 7 here. And then, and your goal would be to have less and less assistance, right? And in some ways, that's exactly how, you know, autonomy could work, as some have referred to it as like a guardian angel, right? That only kicks in when you're about to have an accident. The thing is, when you're racing, you're about to have an accident every second that you're out there, or else you're not going as fast as you can. So it's probably a great way to teach someone how to be on the edge and gradually approach that skill that it takes with the least chance of crashing. I had Mario Andretti on my podcast, the Future Car Podcast, and I asked him about learning to race at the Indianapolis 500, because that's an oval, and you're going at 240 miles an hour on the straightaway, and they come within inches of the wall. And I said, God, were you really ever scared? Because no, it's my job. He said, but I will tell you this. He said, there's two kinds of people at the Indianapolis 500. He said, those that have crashed into the wall and those that are going to crash into the wall. Otherwise, they don't win and they're going to disappear. So, yeah. So figuring out how to get to that point where you know to go just enough, I think would be an excellent application for autonomy.
Yeah, that's a better example for training and all that other stuff. That's basically what they do on video games, right? When you're first learning how to drive, say not Grand Theft Auto, Forza Motorsports, for instance, until you figure out how those cars react, you change the difficulty settings, and the computer does a lot of it for you. And then eventually when you become better, you turn that stuff
off. Yeah, exactly. You mean, and that's a good point, right? And it's almost like taking that and putting it into the real world. Cause usually what happens when you go in the real world, you have to approach it at a much slower pace because you can get hurt if you're not careful.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a firefighter in real life, and our motto in, at least on my shift, is practice until you can't get it wrong.
Well, yeah. I mean, and I guess in firefighting, you got to make split second decisions, right? When you're going into a burning building and figuring out to keep going in or not, or whatever. I suppose you could have an AI system saying, hey, back off. You don't want to go in there.
Well, that's an interesting thing that you say that, because we're getting less and less fires. So we're getting less and less opportunities to operate in fire. So there's these virtual reality simulation type things that are coming up. They're very expensive, like more than $25,000, where you feel like you're actually pulling the hose, and then you get the feedback that you would get for water, but you don't actually feel the heat. And there, guys, I've been doing this since 1993. There are folks who have been in the department for 10 years who have seen a handful of big fires. And it's just because we don't get them enough for them to get that experience of what it's like. We know what it's like when we have a contents fire up in the bedroom, but they don't know what it's like to have an actual like ripping house fire that is driving you to the ground and you're still going in. They don't have that experience, and they're probably not going to, because, you know, things are safer, and that's a good thing. But if they ever do, they don't have that experience to draw from. And you know, maybe they'll make the right decision. Hopefully they make the right decision, but maybe they make the wrong decision because they don't have that within their database of things to pull from for experiences.
Well, if we go back to Formula One and sure. simulation, really any form of racing, it's exactly that. If you limit the amount of time you can actually test on a physical track to say level the playing field, where are you going to get that experience?
Sure.
By working in a simulator, and it's probably easier to simulate a race car on a racetrack than it would be a firefighter in a building. But, you know, like in a racing simulator, the haptic feedback or the ability to feel forces is really, really, really important. I suppose, and if you're going to do this for firefighting, like you said, I bet you an experienced firefighter takes the heat that they feel on the left side of the face is greater than the right side, or I don't know. I mean, you have to. It's a interesting simulation, probably very, very complex, even compared to a racing one, I would think, in some ways at least.
For sure, and there are certain things that how thick and black the smoke is, what their visibility is, the heat, where the heat's coming from. Is it driving us to the ground? If we spray some water up into the ceiling, is that water coming back down? Because if it's not, it's over 212 degrees above us, and it's just turning into steam. And then we need to start making decisions on whether we need to start backing out, or is it okay to still operate in here?
So is AI going to help you, you think? Do you think it can?
You know what? I think yes. I think in the realm of AI helping us do our day-to-day jobs? No, but taking the data, especially as our air packs and everything else gets more sensors, I think taking that and uploading it and with the factors that everybody remembers from the fire, I think we could eventually start building useful models to replicate real-world fires in those situations. And then, you know, you're still not going to get the heat. No matter if you're in a training fire, you're never going to get the heat that you're going to get in a real fire. So that you just have to experience that. Nobody's going to put you in a building that could potentially kill you for training. But I think somebody would have to do a lot of testing. Like UL does a lot of firefighting testing. Somebody would just have to figure out where to put the sensors and build those models. And I think it will eventually help.
Yeah. It's better to die in a video game and get your life back.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't want to make those mistakes in real life for sure. All right. So we got off topic just a little bit. When you see what's going on with F1 and what's going on with motorsports in general, and you look, you know, 5-10 years into the future, what are you looking forward to there?
Well, in terms of the sport itself, or in terms of how it can benefit the automotive industry,
it's really you choose. What do you look at, and you're like, man, I really am into this.
Well, you know, there's in the end, if you're truly a racer and you like racing, you're just looking for. You always look forward to having better and better competition. Because that's the exciting part of it. So there's always going to be that. From a technology standpoint, I think seeing what happens to things like being able to take advantage of electric drive or hydrogen, these types of things, I think is really, really interesting. I think the whole idea of how you utilize data so that you can, during the race or the next race, you can figure out how to configure the car or the driver better. I think that's really, a lot of the things that we've been talking about, I think that's something new that's a little bit untouched that is you know, there in racing, it seems like there's these, and let's take Red Bull. Red Bull is the champion in Formula One, and they're dominating. They've got a designer called Adrian Newey, and he's an expert in designing shapes that are very, that flow well, they're aerodynamically very, very efficient. And he designs with a pencil and paper on a drawing board. That's how he designs. But it's in his head, man. You know, it's in his head, and he's figuring it there. So there's these personalities and these people that are just known, certainly the drivers, but even an engineer like him. Is there a way, right, to take all this data and this information and set the car up better, make the design better, tweak it better? I think there's, just like we were now just talking about firefighters, it's the same thing. And I think that's the challenge in many industries, even in writing, right, that ChatGPT or other applications help you do. So I think that's one of the things that's most exciting. I think that different forms of racing is another one. Alejandro Agag, he went from Formula E to Extreme E in these. I think that was a big step with Extreme E and Extreme H, the hydrogen series, because there's no audience. It's one of the first ones to not have an audience. And so it's truly an online series where you can interact with it in more actively, more connected. There's also another company that we're working with that we're helping with remote racing called Avicar, A-V-I-C-A-R, Avicar. And the idea behind Avicar is it's a cross between the real world and I guess you could say esports, but you will be able to control real cars. They're half scale, so they're half size, but they're very high speed cars remotely from hundreds or maybe thousands of miles away. And the idea is to have a competition where you qualify like American Idol or something like that, right? You bring in all the, you could have a 13-year-old esports person competing against a former, you know, Formula E driver or something like that. But this whole idea of getting connected to what it feels like to be in the car in real time, I know the A2RL was saying that they envision, this is the Autonomous Racing League, they envision things like being able to, during a race, you could become like a ghost car, for instance, and you would actually race against the autonomous cars. Only you would see yourself racing.
Sure.
But you could actually be in the race. There could be hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of races occurring that are completely different. So the whole, I guess the melding of physical racing with augmented reality, remote reality, these types of things, opens up all sorts of possibilities. And also, I think we race on racetracks, but you know, the E1 series is racing on water. There's drone racing now, some with humans in it, some talk of doing it autonomously. What if you combined all those together? I mean, there's all, you know, I think combining, it just like Extreme E did by removing the audience, right? Removing the spectators and doing it all as a online racing series. That, I guess, was really the first step. Remote reality with Avicar is another step. And then engaging in the actual race, like A2RL is talking about, racing against autonomous cars. I mean, I guess it's like a new generation of racing that is probably opening up here. I don't know where it's going to go in the coming years, but a lot of different possibilities, a lot of different combinations.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And what it sounds like to me, correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like they're just building a community of engaged fans, and then they're giving the fans that ability to not just sit and watch, but actually to participate on some level. That actually makes me more excited about racing than before we started this interview. People want to have that experience who are never going to sit in a race car. People want to know what goes behind the scenes who are never going to work on a team. It for whatever reason, and it's not a Real Housewives type of fascination, but it is a having that inside information and feeling like you're a part of that moment. I think that's important for people, and it's important to keep people engaged. I know you do the Future Car podcast, Ed. What else are you up to?
Well, there's certainly in as part of work, a lot of these projects with the different racing teams, like the Extreme E project with Hydrogen, for instance. And a big part of a lot of, at least from the work standpoint, is looking at sustainability and trying to make sustainability part of engineering. But always remembering that you got to make the car go fast, but you got to do it in a sustainable way. And I think one of the other interesting things from that is, and part of that is Siemens, because Siemens, we're in the digital industry software group, which is engineering software. But then as part of our division, digital industries, they also make controllers for factory equipment. And then there's smart infrastructure, which is another division. And these are all like 70,000 people or so, like 350 in all of Siemens. But the smart infrastructure group works with us with the racing teams because they all want to make their buildings more sustainable. EV charging, microgrids, on-site energy storage, hydrogen or whatever it might be, and getting all that to make their operations more sustainable. So we're doing a lot of work in that. And I think sometimes in big companies like Siemens, you have all these divisions, they tend to work within themselves. But if you can combine them and get people to work together, you can come up with some unique things because everybody thinks of problems in different ways. So there's certainly all that.
Excellent. Where would people go if they want to learn more about what Siemens is doing or what you're doing?
Well, certainly the Future Car podcast. Definitely check that out. We interview a lot of race drivers, race engineers, that type of thing. A lot of people in the autonomous and electric car business as well. We did a series a year and a half ago on women driving the future. So for almost a full year, we interviewed nothing but women that were in transportation and racing and things like that. So you can certainly find out there. Siemens is a fascinating company, I think. I mean, they do everything from MRI machines to power generation equipment. Like we were talking about controllers for robots and factories, things like that. So Siemens.com, check that out. We're in the digital industry software group. So one of the big things we do is create these things called digital twins, which is really about simulating something, but not just visually, but also all the physics that's behind it. And in fact, that's exactly what we used on that project for the World Rally Cup for safety. One of the key things on that was to understand the physics behind what LIDAR or radar could do and how it was impacted by rain or dirt or dust in the air. And so we were able to simulate a lot of those things. And so definitely check those out.
Absolutely. And I'll put all the links in the show notes as well. So people, if they can't remember where exactly to go, just go to the show notes. Well, Ed, thank you so much for coming on. And I'm going to be honest, I just threw my notes out immediately. The first two questions were planned. After that, I just threw them out.
I did the same with mine too. So perfect. Perfect match.
It was that means we had a good conversation. So thank you so much for coming on and being generous with your time.
Yeah, thank you, Bodie. Really appreciate it and had a great time. Thanks.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Flat.
All right. I want to thank Ed for being so gracious with his time. Again, this was a fun conversation. I hope you all enjoyed it. I have listened to Ed's podcast, the Future Car Podcast, and it's really good. I think folks who listen to this podcast would also get a lot of value out of his podcast. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes, and I'll also put a link to Siemens Digital in the show notes as well. So you can see everything that they're working on. And honestly, it's a lot. I could list all of the things that they're doing, but it's all over the place. Ed kind of mentioned some of the things that Siemens does, but it's a lot, especially in the motorsports realm. So you can just go check that out on your own. Okie doke, that is it for me today. If you want to email me, it's Bodie, B-O-D-I-E, at 918digital.com. You can also find me on X at 918digital. I hope you all enjoyed the podcast. I hope you all have a wonderful weekend, and I will talk to you on Tuesday.